Okay.
All right, welcome to the first real episode of the podcast.
Which doesn't have a name yet, but hopefully will by the time you hear this.
Yeah, it'll have to.
Yeah, that seems important.
We'll get there.
It's a process. Do you want to do one cool thing at the beginning or at the end?
Let's use it at the end.
Okay. Well, I'm Alex Junaid. That's Ben Wake.
Here we are.
Talking about stuff. This week's question, or topic, or however you want to phrase it, was, what are some, like, pieces of art that you like, but would not necessarily recommend to other people?
Yeah.
So we're gonna explore that a little bit. And, I don't know, do you want to just jump right in?
Sure.
Okay.
So, the first thing that I thought of when we talked about this as a concept was this movie that my family was just so in love with when I was, like, a young teen. And we just kind of kept watching over and over, like, every couple of months. As mm-hmm. And so it's very foundational for me as a person. It is also not necessarily a good movie.
Okay. That seems like a good place to start.
Yeah. So Stealing a Harvard is a comedy where the ostensible plot is there's a guy, he's just saved up $30,000 with his wife so that they can put the down payment on, or with his fiance, so that they can put a down payment on a house, which to them means they can get married.
Okay.
They've been, like, putting off getting married until they could jump right into married life. Then, within the first, like, 15 minutes of the movie, he goes and visits his sister and niece, and it turns out that his niece has just gotten into Harvard.
Like you do.
They then show the main character a home movie of him promising to pay for college if she college. The amount that she needs to cover the remaining expenses at Harvard is about $30,000.
That seems conservative.
they have this whole explanation of how she just has a little chunk left, and it's played for laughs. She's like, just a small chunk, and he pulls out his wallet, and he's like, how much do you need? $30,000. So the movie becomes this conflict between him trying to support the life that he's been carefully trying to build with his wife-to-be, and supporting his family, which he feels honor-bound to do. Okay. So he turns to a life of amateur crime to pay for it, hence Stealing Harvard.
Okay. Who's in this movie?
It stars Jason Lee. His best friend is played by Tom Green.
Okay.
It also Fiona. And
every time I think of Dennis Farina, like, I know he's done so many things, but I always just go right to that one scene in Get Shorty. It's like, it's chilly outside, and it's chilly inside. It's a fucking chilly fest.
He plays about that character.
Yeah.
He's the father-in-law to be. And the wife to be is played by Leslie Mann.
Okay.
So, I mean, like, you also get to throw in random side characters played by Chris Penn, for instance. it's a bizarre movie. It's a very dumb movie, hence Tom Green being cast.
Yeah. Sort of forgot about him.
But the thing about this movie, and part of the reason I love it, is the script is written. It's very complete. Like, if you were to diagram it and compare it to, like, the way that people are told to write scripts when they're in school for, so, like, screenwriting, it's pretty much perfectly follows the arc of everything is supposed to happen this way, rising action, falling action, all the conflicts and that stuff. But it's incredibly stupid. And it's a difficult thing, because Stealing Harvard remains a movie that I watch at least once a year. But I've never, ever recommended it to anybody. because I know that it's something that's emotionally resonant with me. Richard Jenkins is in it, too.
Okay.
Like, the cast is really surprising throughout.
Shows up in fun places.
Yeah. But it... I mean, again, I have never... I can almost any time I start to think, recommend this movie to somebody, I can think of at least one scene that's going to turn them away from it. Or okay. Or at least make them completely stop considering respecting it. So, I mean, like, it's not an example that has a lot of meat to it necessarily, but for me it is, like, the perfect example, and I think it's kind of the archetype of the idea of being able to enjoy a movie but not recommend it.
Mm.
It's something that's, like, emotionally appealing and has a place in your life.
Yeah, personally resonant.
And, I mean, hopefully, I think not everybody has the, like, the self-aware step to go back and say, oh, you know what, this isn't actually good, I just like it. So that's where I'm going to start.
Okay.
It's on Netflix if you're curious about checking it out. It's a lot of fun. If you're a fan of getting high, you'll probably like it.
Okay. I came at it from a very sort of different perspective. Like, I think I started with the media example, because
mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I do, is, like, charge headlong into the most difficult thing possible. And this example captures that pretty well. I think I told you about it last week. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe what it is. I'm going to kind of make the argument against it. And then I'm going to come back around and be like, okay, this is what I liked about it. So, it is the novel Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, which was published in 1996. It is, I don't have the exact page count in front of me, but it's in the neighborhood of 1050, 1100, somewhere up there. It's the story... It's not an easy book to summarize, because there's, like, a lot of weird shit going on, but the basic sort of premise of it is it follows two characters. It follows a kid in a, like, sports high school in Boston that focuses primarily on tennis, and a kind of, like, psychological downfall of his, and this simultaneously down the hill from this high school is a, like, drug rehab halfway house kind of place. And one of the counselors there, who's, like, a former resident who just kind of stuck around, he's the other main character. And it's about him dealing with that situation and kind of finding himself again in a certain way. Also, like... a lot of, like, weird plots about, like, French-Canadian terrorists, and a movie that is so entertaining that watching it basically renders you comatose. That's where the title comes from. Like, it's a hard book to summarize. But, okay, so arguments against it. First of all, it's long as hell. It takes a very long time to read, and this is severely augmented by the fact that the last 100 pages or so consist of, I think it's 323 endnotes that are sprinkled throughout the text, and they range in length from, like, a one or two word comment on the sentence into which they are interjected. Like, I think there's one that's something like, not really, in response to one saying something. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have ones that go on for, like, 10 or 15 pages. Like, one of them is the entire filmography of the director who made the movie in question, which is, you know, as a, like, someone who went to college for film, filled with just so many jokes, it's great. But, like, there's also some that, like, are tangents about, like, calculus or such, but, like, buried in there are a few important plot points, so it's like you can't not read them without missing a lot. Okay. So, it's a lot to take in. It's a book that requires 2 bookmarks in 6 months. Number two, like, kind of going a little further on the it's a lot to take in, it's stylistically very overwhelming. Like, the first 300-ish pages are him, like, Wallace throwing all these different characters at you in little vignettes written in different styles that don't necessarily seem to have a lot to do with each other, and, like, it's very difficult to keep track of. And it does eventually kind of coalesce more or less into a plot, but, like, tracking it is still very difficult because they, like, for example, they don't use numbered time anymore. Years have been subsidized. Okay. So, like, most of the novel takes place in the year of the Whopper. but it also, once the story is established, it doesn't end exactly. It just kind of stops at a certain point, and the rest of it is there in the book for you to, like, parse out, but it requires a lot of, like, really pretty close scrutiny in order to do that. And that's a lot of work that is, you know, it depends on your persuasion, but it's one of those things where it's like, maybe that's not worth the effort if that's not what you're reading for, that kind of thing. It's also a very, and I kind of want to, like, choose my words carefully in this part. So I'm going to quote him, actually, Wallace, on, I think it was Charlie Rose or something like that, where it's like, it's a very male book. There are 2 female characters of consequence who are both very strange, like, kind of cipherous in a way. And it's not just that it's a male book, and this kind of pokes at the heart of it a little bit, is that it's the kind of book that a certain sort of dude recommends to you. And I think basically what it comes down to is terms of, like, why I don't want to recommend this book to people is because I don't want to be that kind of dude. I don't want to say, here's this, like, very difficult, big white male story that's, I mean, I hate to use the word pretentious because, it just doesn't, I don't like it. Like, I was talking with Chris the other day, and he quoted the writer of Penny Arcade, who's also on, like, C-Team and all that stuff.
Yeah, I believe Gabe something or other.
Maybe. The name is, like, so not in my head right now. But he quoted that guy to me as saying, pretentious is a word that only people who aren't themselves creative use. And
I can see that.
I like that. I agree with that, kind of in principle. So, like, I don't necessarily want to use that word here, but I feel like it also kind of applies.
And it's a word that shames ambition.
Yeah. And, like, this is a very, it's a very ambitious book, but it's, like, the kind of this, what it's describing, what it's for, what it's about is not a new story, I suppose. And, like, I know, like, that is only going to make it more, okay, words, that is only going to make it harder for people to have patience with if they are not already inclined to.
Right.
So
you have to be in it for the long haul from the beginning.
Exactly. And, like, it's fine if you're not, because most people aren't going to be. but that said, I do want to make the sort of the case for it, because I did really like it. There's, like, one of the things that he's did in that book, in a couple of his essays that I've read, and in his first novel, which I've also read, Broom in the System. I have not read the unfinished third novel yet, but it's on my list. is like he talks about things that are kind of, it's kind of like Pinkerton by Weezer. Whereas it's like, this is a brilliant exploration of very shameful feelings. So, like, that's why I understand why, what's-his-face from Weezer, that record. Because I wouldn't either if I'd made it. But it's a kind of a door into, like, reckoning with those feelings in yourself for other people. And I think Wallace's writing does that a lot. Like, he inhabits a very shameful, awkward space a lot of the time, and he deals with characters who are dealing with social anxieties and addiction and loss and helplessness and interiority, and all of these things. And I think he does it in a way that is very insightful if you're willing to sort through it. It's also a really, really funny book. Like, the humor in it is odd and unexpected and comes in just bizarre places. Like, for example, the Year of the Whopper. Right. There's another one that I wish I could remember right now. I can't, and I don't have it in front of me. But it's, like, the Year of the Maytag something 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 washer and dryer. Like, it's really long. There's a cat trying to come in here. And then, finally, as far as, like, making a case for it, the sort of, what I would call the kind of the crescendo, the climax of the book, is each of the two main characters has a very long scene that is a kind of crisis for both of them. For Hal, the tennis kid, it's kind of difficult to explain, but as quickly as possible, the kids at this tennis academy play a game. I don't know how to say the word, but I think it means like shield.
Oh, escutcheon?
Yeah, maybe. Or eschaton?
Yeah. I'm guessing as to the pronunciation based on how it looks.
Yeah. Something like that. But the point is that they all, like, stand on various parts of, like, the big giant multi-tennis court area that, like, represents a world map, and then, like, lob tennis balls at each other, and, like, those are bombs, and, like, there's advanced math involved, and there's, like, a kid at a computer on the sidelines doing all the calculations, and it's, like, very high concept, very abstract, and not something that people in real life would ever play, but
right,
it works in the context of the novel. And this big climactic scene is a game of that basically just going completely off the rails and devolving into chaos. And it's all, like, the younger kids watching while the Hal and his friends, the older kids, are kind of, like, off on the sidelines. And the Decemberists made a music video for Calamity Song, I think it is. It's one of their kind of newer one, or, well, I guess not newer anymore, but the guy who directed that music video, who also did a lot of works on Parks and Rec, and whose name is also escaping me right now, I should probably, like, research these things, is, like, a big fan of Infinite Jest, and so, like, the music video kind of does a staging of that scene, and I like it. I don't think it does it justice, though. The other one is Don Gately down the hill at the rehab center. There's a guy at the center who is basically escalating serial killer. Like, he has progressed to killing dogs and, like, is definitely thinking about killing people. But he's still killing dogs, and he kills the dog of, like, a bunch of, I think it's, like, Mexican dudes in Hawaiian shirts or something who are, like, having a party, and they catch him in the act and chase him back to the rehab house, and, like, Don is the guy who's on duty there, and so, like, when that guy runs in, he's like, these guys are after me. Like, he hates this other guy, but he still has to be the one who has to, like, go out there and have this confrontation with them.
Gotcha.
And, like, both of those scenes last for, you know, 20-30 pages. They happen close to the end of the novel and close together, and they're both incredibly poetic and cinematic and interesting, and, like, it was worth plodding through a lot of the novel just to get there, and then, like, find, like, that was kind of the moment where, like, it sounds weird because it's, like, 800 pages into the book, but that's the moment that where I was really sold on it, and then, like, going back and figuring out all the rest of the stuff felt like a worthwhile endeavor, so.
Okay. Very intriguing.
Yeah.
I will skip down my list to another book that is so artistically ambitious that it is off-putting for casual readers.
Okay.
But first, I want to jump
that's
back.
That's my kind of jam.
First, I want to jump back and say I forgot that the cast of Stealing Harvard also includes Megan Mullally and John C. McGinley. I'm trying to sell you just on the cast alone.
Yeah, you are kind of making me want to watch this movie.
So this book, called House of Leaves. I know that
yes.
Alex, you have read it. In preparation for talking about it today, I was talking to one of my roommates and trying to explain the difficulty of the book, and what I resorted to was just getting my physical copy of it and leafing through and showing
you
the shape
of
the
to.
Pages.
Like,
so if you're honestly curious about House of Leaves, I'd say go online and do like a Google image search and look at the way the pages are formatted. One of the first things you'll notice is that there's a variety of fonts used, and that's actually part of the characterization of the book. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, every time that Courier New, like the classic typewriter font, is used, that's the editor's notes from a character named Johnny Truant, who claims to have found the rest of the book as a manuscript in a chest inside of a crazy man's apartment.
Which is just such an intriguing beginning already.
It is. Then the rest of the book, when it's in, like, Times New Roman, like, book font, is the manuscript called The Navidson Record, written by a blind crazy man found in the trunk. And there are also other strange instances of the typesetting changing. For instance, every time that the word house appears,
yeah.
It's written in blue.
I remember that. Certain words in certain colors.
On some pages, they will insert a blue box, which is supposed to represent a window, that has writing in it. When you flip the page, the same writing appears in the same place but mirrored to show you that you are, in fact, looking through a window. Mm-hmm. Some pages will only include one word. Some will have a single line at the top. Some will have a single line at the bottom.
Words scattered randomly around the page.
Oftentimes, this is done to show you kinetic movement that reflects what's going on in the story. At one point, a gun is shot, and the trajectory of the bullet is traced by the lines that belong through the middle of pages. So you actually find yourself flipping pages at high speed as you're only reading half of a sentence per page, mm-hmm. and you feel the speed of the bullet moving. There's also three or four different appendices, some of which are...
Yes.
One of the appendices is all of the letters written to Johnny Truant by his mother while she was in an insane asylum. One of the appendices is titled by the editors simply Contradictory Evidence, and it's things that point out how the manuscript is factually false.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go back and talk about the plot insofar as it exists.
Yeah.
Johnny Truant has one storyline, following his addiction, his relationship with a friend named Lude, and his attempts to go back in his own memory to access a traumatic time in his life on a massive ship, constantly is accessing through dreams, both on purpose and accidentally. Then you also have the narrative of the Navidson record, which follows...
And he's, like, doing all of that as he's reading this record and commenting on it.
Right, these are interspersed. You're getting his story as footnotes in the actual text of the Navidson record. The Navidson record tells the story of a famous photographer whose last name is Navidson. I can't remember his first name off the top of my head at the moment.
I can't either. It's like a description of a documentary film.
Right. And the documentary film that he's making is of a house that he's moved into with his wife and two children. And the house is both logically impossible and incredibly treacherous. When I say logically impossible, I mean they measure all of the rooms on the inside of the house, they measure the outside of the house, and somehow, no matter how many times they measure it, the inside of the house is larger than the outside of the house.
I'm trying really hard not to make a Doctor Who joke.
They also will, at certain points, attempt to go into doorways that didn't exist when they were last in a room, and those doorways will lead through hallways, which explore parts of the house which technically don't exist. And if everything that I'm describing sounds a little bit confusing, that's kind of the point.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be as disoriented by the experience of reading the book as it would be to try to exist in a physical space which couldn't literally exist. The beauty of this book is that, I mean, I think it's something like 600 or 700 pages long. It might be an extra 100,
it's not,
give or take.
It's not that long, especially since so many of the pages are so empty.
Right.
Like, it goes very quickly for what it is.
A big, thick book that you have to carry around for a long time because it's incredibly dense. You constantly find yourself referring to this footnote, this endnote, this appendix, all of these different things, and it's the kind of thing where if somebody is to look at the page as you're reading it, they're going to get confused and ask you what the hell you're reading.
Kat actually did that.
Yeah.
When
I was
reading it, she came in and she was like, what is that? No.
I read this book largely on buses and at lunch at one of my old jobs, and I'm telling you, every time somebody sees the page layout, they start asking questions. That's one of the reasons you can't just recommend this book. It's not a casual read. It's the kind of thing that you have to decide right from page one, I'm going to sit through this whole thing. Sometimes it's going to be boring, sometimes it's going to be confusing, sometimes it's going to be frustrating, sometimes it's going to be hilarious, sometimes it's going to be enlightening, but it's not going to be all of those things consistently, so you have to be ready for it. And, I mean, I, at this point, the book has such a cult reputation that when you say to someone, have you read House of Leaves, they either respond with, no, but I've heard about it, or, yeah, I read it. Or, perhaps, in some cases, the way that I respond, oh my god, right? I think I've outlined the things that make it difficult and the things that make it respectable, but I want to, for just a brief moment, talk about a particular scene that really sticks with me. Right towards the end of the book, when you're in one of Johnny Truant's footnotes about his experience trying to understand, edit, and do something with this novel, or with the manuscript.
Yeah,
because it's not a manuscript
of a film that doesn't exist.
Right. There's a scene right towards the end where Johnny, his attempt to escape the book. He's done what he can with it, and he has found that he can no longer deal with it anymore. And so he ends up in a tiny town called Flagstaff, Arizona, which I just happened to go to college in. And he's at a bar, and he sees this band perform, and they have a song called The 5.5 Minute Hallway, which is a reference, or a 7.5 Minute Hallway, some one of those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And he loses it. He's like, that's a reference to the Navidson record. How do they know? So he starts talking to them after their performance, and it turns out they've been reading the manuscript the whole time. They're huge fans of the movie that it's based on, and they're a big fan of Johnny Truant's because they've gotten a hold of his notes somehow. And so they, like, want to buy him drinks. And it's already a disorienting book, but it's even more disorienting at this point because you have to take a step back and realize that the man exists within the world of the book itself.
Yeah, like, they are reading the same book that you are reading that they are in. Somehow.
Right. Mark Danielewski has written a number of books at this point. He's currently doing an insane series of books. I think it's like 36 all in a series, or like 18
oh,
in all
yeah,
in a series.
I heard about that.
And he's up to like 7, I think. He's got a love story called Only Revolutions, where you read one of the two people involved in the love story's experience on one side of the book, and you flip it upside down and read the opposite direction. And as you get closer, you read one page and then flip to the back and read the other page, and it's all stream of consciousness. And as the pages turn, you get closer and closer to the center of the book, which is actually the closest that the two characters ever are, and as they get further away from each other page-wise, their relationship actually wanes. He's the kind of guy who challenges the concept of what writing can and should be.
Structurally, like, in a, both, like, in the literal physical sense of, like, the arrangement of words on the page, and in that, like, weird meta multiple diegetic thing that the novel does.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's quite possibly the most compelling work of fiction I've ever read, but it is also something I cannot actually recommend to people unless they're already interested. If they say, oh yeah, I'm into that, go, yes, actually read it. That's the most you can do with this book.
A fun place to get a quick sample of it, though, if you're into that sort of thing, the remix of the song Hey Pretty by Poe. She is his sister.
Oh.
And so the remix of that song of hers features him reading a passage from the book.
All right.
So it's the part where, like, he goes on, like, a drive with the girlfriend or wife of the, like, shipping company guy.
Right.
And they're, like, rocketing up the canyon in her sports car or whatever. Like, it's him reading that part over, like, his sister's beat. It's pretty good.
That's intriguing. So the House of Leaves. Check it out, kind of.
Okay, so it's been a little over an hour. Do you want to do, like, one more quick one each and then kind of wrap it up?
Sure. I've got a couple examples that can take less time.
Okay. Because, like, I have a couple more, but they're a little bit shorter. The next one, I guess, sort of falls into that The Ceiling Harvard category.
Mm-hmm.
There's a category of movies that I have in my head, and it has five or six entries. And it's movies that are bad. Like, whatever it is that they're trying to do, I don't think they succeeded at doing it. But whatever it is that they are trying to do is so bonkers that I have to love it because it's not like anything I've ever seen. And a couple examples from that category would be, like, Tim Burton's Mars Attacks.
Okay.
Richard Kelly's Southland Tales. Have you seen that one?
I haven't.
Okay, it's got Dwayne Johnson as the lead, and his, like, characteristic gesture is this little, like, nervous tented fingers up in front of his chest. It's like this, like, tiny little anxiety thing, and, like, seeing a guy that size do that is so funny. There's a scene where cars...
Oh.
I don't know how to describe it any other way. There's a scene where Justin Timberlake is dancing in an abandoned arcade with a bunch of nurses lip-syncing All These Things That I've Done by The Killers. And it's 2 hours and 40 minutes long.
Oh.
So, again, I don't know if I call that a recommendation. That's not the one I was going to talk about, though. The one I was going to talk about is a movie that I remember seeing as a child and have seen a lot since. And that is Barry Levinson's Toys from 1992.
Robin Williams.
Yep. So the cast is Robin Williams, Robin Wright, I don't know if she was Robin Wright Penn at the time or not, but she's Robin Wright now, so. Michael Gambon, a.k.a. Dumbledore 2. LL Cool J, Joan Cusack, and there's at least, like, one more person in it that I'm like, oh yeah, that person, but I can't think of who it is now. But it is the story of a toy factory called Zevo Toys in a kind of ambiguous, pseudo-fantastical world. Like, there is no outside world, really. You don't get a sense of, like, where they are, and it doesn't seem quite right. But this place is, like, very Wonka-ish. Like, there's lots of, like, giant, like, dolls come out of, like, a giant rotating doll's head, and that's supposed to be, like, the factory machine that makes them. It's kind of the aesthetic that we're talking about. And the basic premise is the founder of this factory has died, and his brother has come in to sort of run things, and the brother is, like, a 3-star military general. And so he comes into this whimsical world being all military. LL Cool J has a great line. He's the... I think he's supposed to be, like, Michael Gambon's son. I'm not entirely sure. It's been a minute. But he has a great line. Like, he's in the cafeteria, and he's, you know, putting things on his tray, and he's like, "I'm a military man. I like military meals. I like my peas to be separate from my mashed potatoes so that my peas do not invade my mashed potatoes and cause mixing in my plate." Like, it's stylized in that kind of way. And it ends this, like, giant toy war that just goes completely off the rails and does not make any sense, really.
I've seen the second half of it. Which I don't even know whether that's, like, the more coherent half.
I honestly don't even know either. And so, like, this is another case of something that it's, like, it requires either a very particular temperament or a lot of patience. And it's the kind of thing that it's, like, I don't want to say, like, yes, this is a great movie, because this is not a great movie. It's not particularly well written. The acting is all over the place. The cinematography is overwhelming. Production design, I guess I should say, and cinematography, the mise en scène. Although there's, like, a big argument about whether cinema technically counts as mise en scène, because some academics say it doesn't, some it does, but I'm not going to go into that.
I'm shrugging.
But yeah, it's bizarre and odd and uncomfortable and strange, and it's just like nothing I've ever seen, though, so I have to kind of love it.
Right, it's fair. I wrote down The Room, but in light of all of the recent attention that it's garnered, I don't think that I really have much to say about it that hasn't already been far overstated. So I'm just going to skip ahead and say a TV show that I included on my list of favorite TV shows when we did our, like, let's talk about why we're doing this podcast episode last time.
Okay.
Is actually a show that I love but can't recommend, and that's Gilmore Girls. So, Gilmore Girls is a poorly titled television program that ran for 9 years and now has 4 movies made as, like, sequels, and apparently there's going to be more. What's really at the core of the show is the relationship between 3 generations of women, primarily Lorelai, the mother, Rory, the daughter, and, to a lesser but still very important extent, the grandmother, whose first name I don't even recall at the moment. But the bread and butter of the show is looking at the way that the people town exist with one another in this very whimsical small town world that has capacity for, like, almost soap opera level drama, but more often than not, it's just silly escapades.
Okay.
It's a coming of age tale for Rory, because you watch her through high school and into college.
Okay.
It's also a story about Lorelai's attempt to, like, come to terms with the fact that she needs to create her own life for herself and not just live through her own child.
Is that the other girl's mom?
It is, yeah.
Okay. I've never seen a single episode of the show. Like, I mostly know it by its reputation, so...
Yeah.
Hi, George.
The The thing that makes it difficult to recommend this show is, one, there's a lot of it. 9 seasons, 45-minute episodes each, 22 episodes per season. It's a lot to get into. It's also, I swear, every time that I get on AV Club, there's a new article that's like, hey, remember this episode of Gilmore Girls and how it was the worst thing they ever made?
They've been going through, I think, season 6 recently, and they're like, yeah, this is where it gets bad.
And they say this is where it gets bad every review, as though it was, like, somehow reaching some new level of horrible every single time, which I find, frankly, impossible. But there is, I think, a tendency of the show to sometimes throw aside characterization for drama, and then other times to throw aside drama for characterization. It's a show that is so very much a labor of love for the creators, which started out as Amy Sherman Palladino and became, or I guess it was always Amy Sherman Palladino, and her husband Daniel Palladino became more and more involved in it as time went on. It's just so singular in its vision and in the way that it chooses to execute that vision that it's got this undeniable charm. It's also one of the most cleverly written dialogue shows I think I've seen.
Yeah,
like it's very Sorkin-esque.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's kind of what I know about it, is like things like, I think if I hate to make this reference, but it is a reference point for me, is like, I think they did a parody of it on Family Guy where like they were going back and forth and talking like this the entire time, and this was kind of just what they were doing, like for about 30 seconds where it was two characters talking like this the whole way through.
Yeah, they do, and then because it's Family Guy, the mom and daughter start making out because, according to Seth MacFarlane, that's what everybody was waiting for the whole time. Not weird or creepy. It's difficult to recommend the show for a handful of reasons, some of which I've already sort of touched on, but one of them is it's a show that like really revels in looking at the way that women interact with the world around them and with each other and with men, and it doesn't have like a political point of view, but it is very thoughtful in the way that it approaches it. And I think that
that's probably the best endorsement of it I've ever heard, by the way.
for a lot of people, I think that that's something that makes them turn away because they don't want to watch something that has like a point of view necessarily in that way. It certainly makes me one of very few men who have chosen to watch the show and certainly endorse it. The way that I got turned onto the show was seeing somebody, she showed me a scene, it was like the cold open from like the third or fourth episode of the show, and it was so rapid fire clever and so what's the term? It's so literate. Somebody made a list of every book that it references, and not just in like a silly like, oh yeah, like everybody knows Moby Dick is about a whale. Like it will refer to like the aesthetics
specific points
of a specific novel,
yeah,
and expect you to know what that means. And it does it constantly. The list of books that it refers to in its 9 season run is pages long. Which is not common for a TV show.
No, it really isn't.
Generally, a television show will refer to other TV shows or movies. This one takes a different tactic, and it's because the characters in the show are constantly reading. They take it to heart. And it's funny. It's constantly funny. It's routinely, it's routinely well enough written to keep you engrossed. Like, I know every time that an episode would end, I'd have that itch for just one more. So, I mean, you know what? I'm gonna say I do recommend it. I can't, but I do.
Okay. How many was that?
That's 3 for me.
Okay. You did 3, I did 2. Okay, so I'll do one more. Alright, so I think I'm gonna do a music one. And I have something very particular in mind, and that is Jandek.
Is it a band?
Kind of. I want to very, very briefly tell the story because it is a really fascinating story. And I got most of this from an article that I read several years ago when I was first, like, checking this out. Because, like, where I first heard about him was, like, I was listening to a bunch of Mountain Goats bootlegs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to one from 2004 where John's, like, doing his, like, stage banter thing that he does. He's really good at that. And says something to the effect of, like, holy shit, you guys, Jandek played a live show. And, like, two people go, like, woo! And he's like, yeah, those guys know. So I was like, what's he talking about? Looked it up, and that's kind of how I came across this. And I do not remember the name of the guy who wrote the article. Again, next time I will do some research. But it was a guy who was working as a DJ at a radio station in New York, like a some kind of, like, lo-fi college radio kind of thing in the late 70s. And one day in, like, 1978, this record just kind of showed up because, you know, it's a radio station. People send them records and stuff. And it's a very, like, nondescript, low-quality photograph of, like, a pastel living room on the front. Like, it looks like a photo somebody accidentally took when they were, like, fiddling with the camera. There's nothing particularly special about it. And the only words on the whole package are, like, the names of the songs, the title, which is Ready for the House, and the word Jandek. Or actually, I think it was originally under the name The Units, and then, like, he had to change it. But anyway. Records like that would, like, continue, and the words, like, Corwood Industries, and, like, I think maybe a P.O. Box address in Houston. And records would continue to kind of, like, show up like that periodically, but, any attempt to kind of, like, figure out where they were coming from was sort of stymied. Like, it led back to a P.O. box, but there wasn't really much information associated with the person who had that P.O. box, and this person, like, did not really communicate with anyone. It was not clear, like, if it was a single person or a band, because there were definitely, like, multiple people involved. But as the, and all of the covers were like that, where they're just kind of these, like, weird photographs that are, like, very particular style. Like, you can tell a Jandek album cover when you see one. And they are, the ones that feature people frequently feature the same person at different ages, in places that are, over the years, identified as, like, being across the world. So, like, it became kind of this whole thing of, like, who is this? What is this? And that was accentuated by the style of the music, which is kind of where I'm going with this, and I'll finish the story after I talk about that. But, like, the music has gone through several styles, but it's all kind of the same idea. Trying to think how to phrase it. It's kind of anti-music in a way, which is not to say noise. And that's part of what's fascinating about it. Because, like, mostly when you have, like, someone who is clearly doing kind of an avant-garde thing and, like, confronting you with non-musical sounds presented in a musical way, you're gonna get stuff like Merzbow, where, like, it's a loud and, you know, feedback. Like, the best way to describe Merzbow is, like, if you've ever heard the sound, like, a tube amp makes when you kick it, picture that, and then picture sawing it in half with a chainsaw, and then you kind of get the idea of what a Merzbow song sounds like. But Jandek is not like that. Like, a lot of the records are just, like, an acoustic guitar and voice. Some of them are more fully instrumental, or instrument orchestrated, arranged, I guess. There are also ones that are entirely a cappella or spoken word. The songs range in length from, like, your average kind of song, like, you know, 2-3 minutes, to ones that, like, the whole album is a single song, or, like, it's four songs and four CDs long, things like that.
Okay.
But even when it's just, like, him and the acoustic guitar, which was kind of, like, sort of the first era, I guess, was sort of mostly that, it's not in any kind of musical tuning, and it's in such a way that, like, this is someone who clearly understands music and is going out of his way to not do that. Like, it's fascinating. And the lyrics are, like, in this kind of, like, country bluesy sort of tradition. They're not anything particularly revelatory, but, you know, they're not bad. But let me put it this way. This was my, like, clear the party music in college. Because if you put this on, people will leave.
I'm so intrigued. You've had me sold for a while.
And so, like, that's why it's not something I can recommend, because it does take a very particular sort of person to even want to give it a try, because it sounds bad. It runs very contrary to all the rules and ideas of music that we are used to, except for the times when it doesn't. There are a couple records that don't do that. There are a couple of songs that don't do that. It's, like, it's very unpredictable and wrong-footing. And speaking of which, I do want to finish the story, which was, you know, there had been a couple of attempts to interview whoever was behind Corwood Industries and what was going on over the years, but basically up until 2004, nobody had a really solid idea of what any of this was, or at least very few people. And then there was a festival in Scotland in 2004, I think it's called the Install Festival. It's like an avant-garde musical festival. And the last band played their set and did their thing. And after that, like, a couple of them stayed on stage, and this, like, 6.5 foot tall, ghostly skinny guy in, like, his late 50s or 60s in a black fedora comes out and starts playing, and it's him. And, like, a couple of people in the audience basically shit themselves, and everybody else was confused. And since then, and that was 04, since then, I don't know about the last couple of years, but up through the last couple of years, he had played, you know, a handful of shows around the world every year. Never the same thing twice. Like, the songs he plays at shows are not songs off his records, and not things you'll hear at other shows either. One gets the impression that it is largely improvised, but it's hard to tell. The opportunity to see him in Denver with a couple of people who did not know what they were in for, which was really fun. And, like, when I saw him, like, he was playing bass. He had, like, a woman who was basically just kind of yelling into a mic, but, like, in a way that worked. The drummer was doing stuff like dragging beads across his kit. And the show was, like, 2.5 hours long, and it was, like, the closest to being on acid without actually being on acid that I've ever been.
Huh.
The sort of the footnote is that I think, I want to say in the past couple of years, some information has come out about this guy and, like, what's going on there. I have purposefully avoided it.
Oh.
And there's a great quote that kind of sums up why, and it's from a movie, and, like, it's kind of soured for me now because it's Kevin Spacey who says it. But the movie is Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, directed by Clint Eastwood from the late 90s, also starring John Cusack and I think Jude Law and some other people. It's pretty good. I like it. Like, it's a weird one, but it's all right. But Kevin Spacey is this, like, rich Southern guy, and he is accused of murdering his lover, which is, anyway. But he has, like, a bunch of paintings, and he's, like, taking John Cusack, who's a reporter, around his house and showing him them. And one of them, he's, like, basically mentions, like, okay, this is an overpaint. like, there's something under there. And, like, John Cusack is, like, you know, very, like, well, what's under there? Have you had it x-rayed? And he just kind of looks at him. He's like, I'd rather, like, not knowing. And it's like, that's how I feel about Jeddak. Like, I don't want to look it up. Let the mystery be.
Right. Okay. I'm going to check out Jeddak.
I would recommend, let's see. I think it's Ready for the House is a good one. Chair Beside a Window is a really good one. And then there's one from around the same time as Chair Beside a Window, and I can't remember what it's called right now, but, like, tracks on it are, like, one of them is called Lavender, one of them is called, like, The Cat That Walked In From Somewhere or something. That actually might be the best place to start, because if I remember correctly, that album is one that is, like, fairly more musically traditional. So it's kind of an entry point into the sort of later stuff where, like, you get into the record and quietly talking for an hour.
All right.
Okay. So
into the what's new this week?
Yeah, one cool thing. Do you want to go first or shall I?
Go for it.
Okay, well, it's also a band thing, and I forget exactly how I stumbled on it, but I was leafing through new music the other day, and I caught the track Desire by a band from Canada called Ought, as in I ought to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a kind of a post-punky thing with, like, a little bit of a jazzy touch to it. But I listened to it, and then I tried to, like, listen to some other things, and I just kept coming back and listening to it again. I think I listened to it, like, 10 times. And then I listened to their first two albums at work and really liked both of them. And their third album that has Desire on it is called Room Inside the World, and it is going to come out here very shortly, February 16th. So I don't know when this will be on the air. It might have already come out by then. Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah. My thing this week is I just finished a science fiction novel called Nova, which I highly recommend. It's by an author named Samuel R. Delaney. He does a fantastic job of creating a very complete world. At one point, he creates this dialect where all verbs in a sentence get pushed to the very end and used in inverse order.
Ow, that hurt my brain.
Nonetheless, completely easy to understand.
That sounds fascinating.
It is. It's a story about this starship captain who has an idea about how to find far more fuel for transportation than anyone has ever conceived of before, and he gathers a crew of basically the best misfits, pardon me, the most, like, ridiculous group of misfits he can find. One of them is, like, a gypsy who plays it's kind of like a clarinet, but it creates smells, sounds, physical sensations, and, like, visuals all at the same time.
Okay.
Another character is a 7-foot-tall man who's recorded 10,000 hours of notes on a novel that he's supposedly going to write.
I've been there.
One character is a tarot card reading expert who just has, like, the best sass. It spans worlds. It's about society and philosophy and all of the things that good science fiction are really about, but it's also just mechanically so well written that as a writer I was blown away. Some of the descriptions of things, I mean, he'll say, like, things along the lines of like, the clouds rasped through the sky blearily, and you're like, how does a cloud rasp? I still know what you mean,
yeah,
but damn you.
What's his name again?
Samuel R. Delaney. Okay. It's Delaney with one E.
Okay.
Definitely worth checking out. I had it recommended by a friend I work with, and the first couple pages it was neat, and by the time I was about 30 pages in, I was like, alright, yeah, this is really legit. It's a book that gets better every page you turn. So that's my recommendation. Check out Nova.
Alright. And I think that puts us at like roughly an hour 40, which is perfect.
Yeah, it's not bad at all.
So, alright, well, this has been the first episode of, well, the first real episode of whatever this is.
I have a tagline for us, maybe.
Oh, okay, what do you got?
Critics in the New Age.
Okay.
It's a first draft.
Right.
We're going to edit this part out.
We'll workshop it. All right, well, I guess that's George is washing his face, so that's the fat lady singing.
Thanks for listening. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.